Namaskar. I'm very happy to welcome you all here again, one more time, on behalf of all the Savitude of Unseen. Extremely happy that so many of you could come. Special welcome to Dr. Motswami. I think today is a specially significant occasion, because this is not only the concluding session of one of your study camps, which has gone on for 10 days, it's even the concluding session of the whole series of Savitri study camps. That means that it's the culmination of a yamna that's extended over 13 years, I believe. So that makes it very, very special. And it's wonderful that so many of you can be here today. So I don't think that I really have anything else to say at this stage. I'll have a few remarks to make at the end. But we'll just ask Dr. Motswami to start.
I have been asked to announce that a new reprint of all the 17 volumes of the collected works of the mother are going to be released very soon. It will be 17 volumes, and the size will be what is called a handy crown size edition. This is the size of the books. It will be 17 books. And the most happy part of that news is that if booked before 31st of August 2003, it's going to cost you only 900 rupees, which is less than $1 for each book. This is possible because we have geniuses in the publishing line like Mr. Himmat Singhaji, who is here. But this time it is Vak and Shabda together, so you can book this either at the Vak shop or at the Shabda if you want to have all the 17 volumes. And the it's most likely that all these books will be available by the end of this year, 2003. You won't have to wait until the end of this century. So this is an announcement, and if you're interested in collecting samples of this, copies of this, they are available somewhere out there. This is a special offering on the occasion of the 125th birth anniversary of the mother. Now, this is the concluding session of the current series of our Savitri study camp, which began 11 days ago in the beach office of Sri Aurobindo Society in Pondicherry. Those of us who have been participating in these study camps have been recipients of special grace from the mother, because it is no easy matter to go on holding these study camps year after year for 13, 14 years. This has been possible because we have had the blessings and the grace of the mother raining on us all these years. And one of the happy developments in subsequent years has been that we have been able to come here for the concluding session. And so all those who like to talk about Savitri, listen to Savitri, etc., whether they are from Auroville or from Sri Aurobindo Society or from the ashram or from anywhere else, they are all joined together here. Savitri basically is this uniting consciousness. And on behalf of all of you, I am very grateful to Shridhavan and her very dedicated team for making this possible. And finally, I would like to offer my warm gratitude to all of you who have been able to join us here year after year, waiting in the sun for the bus. And this has been a very nice setting, And the only thing is, they're wondering each time we take photographs, they come exactly the same. So they're looking for volunteers who will go up the tree and take photographs from the tree. We haven't yet found them. Now, this time, during our study camp, we took up book 12, the epilogue. And as you know, like book 8, the book of death, book 12 also has received very little attention from Sri Aurobindo during his subsequent revision of the epic. And as our friend Richard Hartz has remarked, this is something very interesting about it, because in the legend of Savitri and Satyavan, the two facts are the death of Satyavan and his resuscitation, his revival, his coming back from life. And the death is the subject of book 8, and his resuscitation is the subject of book 12. And exactly these two books have not received much attention from Sri Aurobindo, which suggests that Sri Aurobindo was not interested in the fact of death itself or in the fact of revival, but in the spiritual facts behind these. There are spiritual forces behind death and spiritual solution to the problem of death. However, although this book didn't receive much attention from Sri Aurobindo in the later stages, it is still a very beautiful piece of narrative poetry. The first version which Sri Aurobindo wrote between 1600 and 1800 probably was a very inspired writing, and many of the lines from the earlier version are still today found, and they are wonderful, as great as poetry, as narrative poetry. This section, of course, it doesn't have the epic elevation of some of the other parts of Savitri, but as narrative poetry, even this epilogue, which is in large part the same as it was in the first version, reads very well, limpid, beautiful English poetry, which has great lines. Just to give you some sample of what this kind of poetry is in this canto 14, book 12, I'll read just an excerpt. This is what Savitri says in this concluding book or concluding canto: "All now is changed, yet all is still the same." Satyavan is wondering where he is, where he had been, and he does see a change in Savitri, so he's wondering whether it's the same Savitri or the different Savitri, yet he doesn't know how to deal with her. So he says, "All is now changed, and yet all is still the same. No, we have looked upon the face of God, our life has opened with divinity. We have borne identity with the Supreme and known His meaning in our mortal lives. Our love has grown greater by that mighty touch and learned its heavenly significance. Yet nothing is lost of mortal love's delight. Heaven's touch fulfills but cancels not our earth. Our bodies need each other in the same lust. Still in our breasts repeat heavenly secret rhythm, our human heart beats passionately close. Still am I she who came to thee mid the murmur of sunlit leaves upon this forest verge. I am the Madran, I am Savitri. All that I was before, I am to thee still, close comrade of thy thoughts and hopes and toils. All happy contraries I would join for thee." This is a small sample from this canto, which, as I told you, is a very good example of the kind of poetry that you find in this particular book. As I said, in the original Vyasa's legend, the events related in this book take almost 50% of the space. How they met, what Satyavan's father said, what Satyavan's mother said, what they said to each other, how they cried, you know, this with delight, etc., etc. And Sri Aurobindo didn't interest in these things, but to bring it to a conclusion, and as you know, he was in a terrible hurry during the last stages, and Nirodha reminded him about book 8 and book 14, book 12, he said, "Oh, that we'll think about it later," or something of that kind he mentioned. he knew exactly what was happening, and so, and yet, this seems to be, in one sense, a good conclusion for the legend, although it's not as great as the beginning of the epic. The beginning of the epic, as you know, Sri Aurobindo revised it 50 times. This is information Richard has given to us. There are 45 copies of the first version, and on the typescripts he has made 5 different typescripts. He has made further changes. So in all 50 versions, I don't think many of us have read, except Richard, the first canto 50 times. I haven't. That's the care Sri Aurobindo bestowed on some parts of Savitri, and there are other parts of Savitri, like book 11, canto 1, the great benediction of the Supreme Divine. That's about 500 flowing lines, and I don't think Sri Aurobindo had time to revise these lines. Maybe Nirodha read out to him these lines the second day, and so for days on end he was just dictating them, and he was just taking them down. And this particular book that we dealt with was, as I said, written a long, long time ago, between 1916 and 1918. So we completed this reading of book 12 on the third day, and our study camp was of 11 days, so we had 8 extra days. And during these extra days, what we tried to do is review Savitri by looking at certain major themes, so that our study would have some focus. And the themes we looked at were Sri Aurobindo's vision and its fulfillment in Savitri. Secondly, mother's footsteps in Savitri. Third, the Sri Aurobindo's vision of our future. These were the three themes we pursued during the last 8 days. Now, I will have to review it in another fashion, and I will try to do it in the limited time we have at our disposal. We don't realize it sufficiently that the goals Sri Aurobindo defined for his yoga were not only revolutionary for his times, they are revolutionary even for today, except that very few people contemplate them, think about them, think about their implications. Traditionally, spiritual paths have two kinds of possible goals. One is finding your place, a permanent a place in some Vaikuntha or some Kailash, some special heaven or paradise, where you will be waited upon by 8 damsels, where you will have, you know, swimming pools, hot water, etc., etc., no taxation, you will never grow old. That kind of a fulfillment you can gain by doing the right kinds of things while you are here. We have that too, but the Indian tradition prefers another kind of goal, and that is either merger into nirvana, getting out of the cycle of death and birth. So if you ask any Indian, learned or ignoramus, ask you if it's a spiritual kind of mood, and ask him what's your life's greatest ambition, he'll say, my life's greatest ambition is to get out of this cycle of birth and death. He hasn't thought about it, but by virtue of being Indian, it is in his bloodstreams, and he is supposed to say it, and he says it. I gave you an example last time of Lata Mangeshkar. When Lata Mangeshkar asked this question, she said the same thing. My life's great ambition is to get out of the cycle of birth and death. For somebody like Lata Mangeshkar to say this, it's inconceivable. If I were there, I would have said, oh Lord, bring me back to this world so that I can give delight to all millions of Europeans and Africans and Americans to whom I haven't been able to give, you know, the kind of delight I have been able to give to Indians this time. Why do all people want to get out of this cycle of birth and death? I don't understand. People haven't thought about it, but you are supposed to say this. Sri Aurobindo brought a revolutionary idea that spirituality is not a way to cancel life, to abrogate life, but to bring fulfillment to life. And he defined it. He says it's not only fulfillment for the man's spirit, but also for the instruments of the man's spirit, which is for the mind, for the vital, and for the body. And he defined it as clearly as possible. And number two, he said, our aim is not to bring perfection of any kind just for one individual, or this is not an individual's achievement. We would want to make it accessible to the whole of humanity. So it is a new consciousness that settles there and is accessible to all, the whole of humanity. This something is new. This collective aspect is the demand of the time spirit. Anything great and good, you can't just have it for yourself. If it is good and it is great, you must also make sure that everybody else can participate in it. And Sri Aurobindo was ahead of his times, and even those days he kept saying, I don't want the supramental consciousness for an individual, but it has to be the gain for the whole of this earth consciousness. This was his definition of the aim of yoga. We won't go into the methodology of this yoga because it's not really relevant for our purposes. Now, in Savitri, as you know, there are two biographies and one autobiography. It contains a narration of Sri Aurobindo's, a description of Sri Aurobindo's yoga, which is Ashwapati's yoga, so that part is autobiographical. It also is a spiritual biography of the mother, so there are many, many passages which remind you of the mother in Savitri, and the mother herself in Agenda in other places has said that much of Savitri is just a narration of her direct experiences. And some of the experiences she had even 30 years before she came to Pondicherry. And she never mentioned about these experiences to Sri Aurobindo. Some she mentioned, but some she never mentioned. And yet, Sri Aurobindo was able to depict these experiences, write about these experiences in Savitri. Of course, there is a third biography here, and the third character in Savitri is you and me. It is our biography. How did we get to come here at this stage? Why are we here? Why is it that our life is in such a mess? Where are we supposed to go? How are we supposed to go? What after man? How after man? These are questions he discusses in the whole of this epic. Now, the first part, he very beautifully summarizes the central issue in Savitri's life. And he says, I don't think you have the copy you have? Okay. Page 17, line 229, he very neatly summarizes what is the issue in Savitri's life. What is it that really should matter? What is it we should look for? He says, for this she had accepted mortal birth, and to wrestle with the shadow she had come, and must confront the riddle of man's birth, and life's brief struggle in dumb matter's night, whether to bear with ignorance and death, or hew the ways of immortality, to win or lose the godlike game for man, was her soul's issue thrown with destiny's dice, but not to submit and suffer was she born, to lead, to deliver was her glorious part. This was the issue of her life, and as he says, whether to bear with ignorance and death, we have always made compromises with ignorance and death. We have said to ignorance and death, all right, give me relief from this, let this world belongs to you, you can reign here as long as you like. So we have always sought escape from this world, we have refused to confront the problem of ignorance and death, and we have said this cannot be changed. This is the ultimate dispensation of God here for earth. Who are you and me to change this, to challenge this? But Savitri has come precisely to challenge this. This is what is what this says. Ashwapati's yoga, as you know, and this takes about 300 pages, 3 to 320 pages, about 12,000 lines. Nobody can write about someone else's life or yoga in such detail. So it's very clear it must be Sri Aurobindo writing about himself. And he himself has given us some indication what this yoga was about and what are the different stages we have to look for in this yoga. First he says, first I describe the psycho-spiritual transformation of Ashwapati, which is described in cantos 3, 4 and 5 of book 1. Then Ashwapati undertakes an exploration of all the worlds, right from the subtle physical, then the various vital worlds, the mental worlds, the spiritual worlds, and he is after one principle, he is after that creative principle which will help him or which will show him how to transform the nature of life, how to bring perfection to life. And in spite of all this exploration, and this exploration is the theme of book 2, 15 cantos, nearly 200 pages of spiritual experience of the various worlds. At the end of it all, he is about to enter into Nirvana. And this is a very great moment, I think, in the spiritual history of mankind, and particularly of India, where Ashwapati is about to enter Nirvana. But something in him says there is another destiny, a more glorious destiny. This is in some sense comparable to what happened, the episode or legend people talk about in the life of Amitabha Buddha. Buddha too, when he was about to enter Nirvana, came back. Buddha had great compassion and love for humanity, but I do not think Buddha had any particular remedy to correct the problems of life. He only thought, I don't want to be the first one into Nirvana, I would like to take with me as many people as possible with me into Nirvana. So the only way he has of saving mankind is to physically lift them if possible and throw them into Nirvana. Very laudable, and we must praise him for that, and he has been declared as an avatar for that. But how many people can you save like this? Ultimately, what is it you are trying to teach them? You are trying to teach them how to escape from this life. You are not teaching them anything new or how to bring perfection to this life. And that is something new about Sri Aurobindo. Although with Amitabha Buddha, he had compassion for mankind. He had something more than compassion. It's not enough. Compassion and philosophy do not go very long. You need something more. You need a power. And Sri Aurobindo had discovered this power. And he has already written about it, and he finds that this power is not available in any of the realized worlds, so he goes into the transcendental world. And in the transcendental world, he experiences this, and suddenly he realizes that there is a world of perfection which is waiting to come down, and he gives a wonderful, beautiful description of this world of perfection, which is called the supramental world. And if you have the book, you have it on page 322. I'll just read just a little bit. I can see the evening shadows getting longer and I don't have much time, but I will do my best and see how much I can cover. This is the Ashwapati's experience of the supramental, which is something which he sees in the transcendental world, where the past and the present and the future are just one. It's there. He experiences this, and the experience is described. There are two sections which describe this. I'll read only a little small excerpt on page 322, the last line. A bliss, a light, a power, a flame-white love, caught all into a soul immense embrace. Existence found its truth on oneness breast, and each became the self and space of all. The great world rhythms were heartbeats of one soul. To feel was a flame discovery of God. All mind was a single harp of many strings. All life a song of many meeting lives. For worlds were many, but the self was one. This knowledge now was made a cosmos seed. This seed was cased in the safety of the light. It needed not a sheath of ignorance. Then from the trance of this tremendous clasp, and from the throbbings of that single heart, and from the naked spirit's victory, a new and marvelous creation rose. Incalculable outflowing infinitudes, laughing out an unmeasured happiness, lived their innumerable unity. Worlds where the being is unbound and wide, bodied unthinkably the egoless self, rapture of beatific energies, joined time to the timeless, poles of a single joy, white vasts were seen where all is wrapped in all, there were no contraries, no sundered parts, all by spiritual links were joined to all, and bound indissolubly to the one. each was unique, but took all lives as his own, and following out the stones of the infinite, recognized in himself the universe. This is a longish passage. I will leave this and go on to the next canto, where Ashwapati would like to bring this world to on earth, but Ashwapati is Sri Aurobindo. Even when he experiences this supramental world, he is still worried about the earth. Right from there, from the world to be in the future, he is experiencing this future. And even when he is experiencing this blissful future, he is worried about you and me, and says, how do I make this accessible to mankind? That's number one. And he sees his own pitiable, small, little, fragile body lying at the edge of the world. And he says, what about that body? That's also part of me. Here, my spirit is all fulfilled. It has bliss, it has oneness, it has everything. But shouldn't my body also be participating in this perfection? How do I do it? These are Ashwapati's concerns, because they are Sri Aurobindo's concerns. Basically, they're his concerns. And finally, since he doesn't know any way of bringing these things down himself, he approaches the Supreme Divine Mother, who is the Adhishtatri of this creative, of this world, and prays to her. The first thing that the Divine Mother says, man is exactly where he belongs. You shouldn't try to accelerate the progress, because he is not yet ready to say goodbye to ignorance. He likes to wallow into ignorance. Let him have a long enough innings, I will wait. Someday he will get this perfection, but not yet. But Ashwapati, being Ashwapati, he says, how shall I rest content with mortal days and the dull measure of terrestrial things? I who have seen behind the cosmic mask the glory and the beauty of thy face. Hard is the doom to which thou bind'st thy sons. How long shall our spirits battle with the night and bear defeat and the brute yoke of death? We who are vessels of a deathless force and builders of the godhead of the race. A few lines down, it says, ever the centuries and millenniums pass. Where in the grayness is thy coming's ray? Where is the thunder of the victory's wings? Only we hear the feet of passing gods. We're all ready to receive gods, and we have kept everything ready, but we hear shuffling footsteps, and then somebody comes and says, gods have gone away. Wait for the next time. And man is almost, you know, reduced to despair. And if you trust his judgment, he will be forever lost in the labyrinthine intellect or mental consciousness that he has woven around him. The only solution to this is, O Divine Mother, for you to come down and take on this responsibility of bringing this new consciousness down. Human effort, human power, human strength is inadequate to do this. Only an avatar can do this. And so, he praying to the Divine Mother and is saying, omnipotence, girdle with the power of God, movements and moments of a mortal will, packed with the eternal might, one human hour, and with one gesture change all future time. Let a great word be spoken from the heights, and one great act unlock the doors of fate. The mother listens to this prayer and agrees to send an emanation of her or an avatar of hers, and that's a beautiful declaration, a promise, which is very well known. I won't read the whole of it for want of time, but I'll read a few lines. It's on page 346, about four lines from the top. O strong forerunner, I have heard thy cry. One shall descend and break the iron law, change nature's doom by the lone spirit's power. A limitless mind that can contain the world, a sweet and violent heart of ardent calms, moved by the passions of the gods shall come. All mights and greatnesses shall join in her. Beauty shall walk celestial on the earth. Delight shall sleep in the cloud net of her hair. and in her body, as on his homing tree, immortal love shall beat his glorious wings. The music of briefless things shall weave her charm. The streams of heaven shall murmur in her laugh. Her lips shall be the honeycombs of God. Her limbs his golden jars of ecstasy. Her breasts the rapture flowers of paradise. She shall bear wisdom in her voiceless bosom. Strength shall be with her like a conqueror's sword, and from her eyes the eternal's bliss shall gaze. A seed shall be sown in death's tremendous hour, a branch of heaven transplant to human soil. Nature shall overleap her mortal step. Faith shall be changed by an unchanging will. This is a promise made by the Supreme Divine Mother. And as you know, in Vyasa's Savitri, the legend, Savitri is an exceptionally talented, exceptionally gifted young woman, but there is no reference to her being an avatar. And recent research, research by Richard and others have shown that this idea that the mother is an avatar, I think I have further said a little bit about it. This is the seed, this became the seed of the revision of Savitri which Sri Aurobindo undertook after 1926 or 1928. It is the mother's responsibility now to bring down the new consciousness. And even when you look at the description of the birth of Savitri that Sri Aurobindo has given here, one has no doubt at all that Sri Aurobindo means her to be an avatar. And as we are told in the pages of Essays on the Gita, an avatar comes down particularly when there is an impasse, a kind of a blockage to the progress of evolution. And only an avatar can clear this. So the avatar is needed. But it looks to me at this time you had twin avatars. The Sri Aurobindo came as an avatar, the mother came as an avatar. I wonder whether there have been any feminine avatars in the past. Probably the dispensation, the change now, the transformation anticipated now is so radical, so unheard of in the history of this evolution, that probably the Divine Mother herself also had to come down as an avatar, because the work this time was not of the ordinary kind. The work, the magnitude of the issues was such that two avatars had to come. The Supreme Divine Mother also had to come. And you should realize that this doesn't happen very often in the history of evolution. Those of us who were alive during this century had good fortune that we were here on earth at the same time when the first feminine avatar was on earth, the mother was on earth. So this is something to celebrate, and I thought I should mention this because we are this year celebrating the 125th birth anniversary of the mother. Well, from now on, it's basically Savitri's, Yoga Savitri's birth. I don't want to read that passage where it's very clear that Sri Aurobindo wants us to see Savitri's birth as the birth of an avatar. And also there are a number of passages in book 4, and if you read them, those of you who are in the ashram in the 50s and 60s might even begin to hear the footsteps of the mother. They are so closely modeled after the mother. We can immediately see this is the person Sri Aurobindo is describing in these lines. I won't go into all these things, but not because not many of you were in the ashram in the 50s and 60s. But those of you who were probably immediately see this must be the original on which this portrait of the mother is based. Well, there is later on a whole book called the Book of Love, and I think that the Book of Love belongs to the legend of Satyavan and Savitri. It has not much to do with the mother's life or yoga here. Sri Aurobindo develops it into a very beautiful book, and I have said in many places if Sri Aurobindo had written nothing else but just the Book of Love, he would have still left his indelible mark on English literature. There is nowhere else in world literature such beautiful poetry, and based on love fulfilled. You have great poetry and love frustrated, love, you know, but love fulfilled is hardly regarded as a fit subject for poetry. But here, in book 5, it's wonderful poetry, but we have to leave it alone, because that doesn't immediately concern my frame of reference right now. We now go on to the book of yoga. Savitri, as you know, in the original story, performs a vrata, which is a triratra vow, for 3 days and 3 nights. She performs a vrata close to the day of the day in which Satyavan was to die. Now, Sri Aurobindo has taken this event and transformed it to Savitri's yoga. Just as Ashwapati's yajna becomes Ashwapati's yoga and gets an expansion of about 12,000 lines. What Vyasa describes in 10 lines, Sri Aurobindo describes in 12,000 lines. Similarly here, the austerities practiced by Savitri in the Mahabharata legend get converted into Savitri's yoga. And here there are many, many places, many, many passages which remind you of Sri Aurobindo's yoga, which remind you of the special approach the mother developed called the psychic approach. It is that approach that she basically took. Ashwapati's yoga is the yoga of a scientist. Very leisurely, very impersonal. He has all the time at his disposal, and he observes unmoved whether he is in the vital worlds of gods or paradise, or whether he is in the world of falsehood or darkness or whatever. His job is to report, his job is to observe, and that's what he does. And he goes like a cone, ascending from one level to another level, one level to another level. Savitri's yoga has a different kind of tempo. Hers is more impassioned, more dynamic, more direct, and goes through her psychic being. And the other difference that I think there is in Ashwapati's yoga, you have basically the psycho-spiritual transformation of Ashwapati, the psychic transformation and also spiritual transformation.